Hi, it's the show on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein.
And I'm Mark Brody, and this is our podcast version of the program. The show is one of our original productions. It's a curated program of news and features from Phoenix and the state, along with national and international stories.
You can also find segments and additional information at theshow.kjzz.org.
Thanks for listening to the podcast.
Maricopa County Sheriff Joe Arpaio goes back to court tomorrow. KJZZ's Jude Joffe Block reports a federal judge will be deciding what comes next after finding the sheriff and three aides in contempt of court.
To understand why Sheriff Joe Arpaio is now in contempt of court, we have to go back to 2011. That's when federal judge Maurice Snow ruled the sheriff's office must stop making immigration arrests. But the sheriff ignored that order for 17 months. And during that time, Cecilia Wong of the American Civil Liberties Union says he violated the civil rights of Latino drivers.
They were at risk of being arrested for no reason, of being targeted for traffic stops, apparently because of their race.
Last year, the same judge initiated civil contempt proceedings against the sheriff for failing to follow his order, as well as other violations like withholding evidence. The sheriff and his attorneys declined to comment for this story, but this is his lawyer, John Masterson, speaking to reporters last fall.
Were there mistakes made? Absolutely. Were court orders violated? Absolutely. But the key we wanted to get across to the court, and the public, for that matter, is that it was not intentional.
But in a massive contempt ruling released earlier this month, Judge Maurice Snow found Arpaio's violations were intentional. In fact, Snow concluded Arpaio purposefully ignored the 2011 order to help his reelection bid. Again, the ACLU's Cecilia Wong.
This is just not a police agency that can be tolerated in our system of government.
The judge will be deciding what must be done to correct the agency and compensate people who were wrongfully detained. The plaintiffs want Arpaio to personally pay $300,000 towards that effort. They say hundreds of people were wronged.
And every one of those victims, as many as we possibly can, should be identified, located, and compensated for the terrifying experiences that they had.
But a debate is brewing on where the money for that program should come from. Arpaio's attorney sent a memo to the judge Friday saying the sheriff was devastated by the ruling. So far, the sheriff and his chief deputy have volunteered to personally donate $100,000 to a Latino civil rights organization and agreed to cede some oversight authority to an independent entity. Arpaio could face much tougher penalties if the judge decides to refer the case to a criminal prosecutor. Plaintiffs have asked for that, as well as possible perjury and obstruction of justice charges. If there is a criminal contempt prosecution,
a criminal violation could call for imprisonment, incarceration.
Paul Charlton is the former U.S. attorney for Arizona. He believes the judge's contempt ruling contains clues about what's in store because he uses words like intentional and deliberate to describe the sheriff's actions.
Those are words which signal very clearly that there is a very high likelihood that there's a criminal prosecution in Joe Arpaio's future.
Hey, hey, ho, ho! Racist Joe has got to go! Hey.
At a rally outside the sheriff's office last week, a few dozen protesters, most of them Latino, held signs calling for Arpaio to face criminal charges. One of those protesters was Salvador Reza.
The only punishment for Arpaio is for him to taste the same thing he did to everybody else.
Reza says that means prison. But Arpaio has different plans. The 83-year-old has been stumping for Donald Trump and is also running for his seventh term as sheriff. Arpaio's campaign manager, Chad Willems, says the sheriff is enjoying a groundswell of support.
He does what he says he's going to do, and he's not afraid to go into a fight. He's never taken an easy way out of anything, and I think people respect that.
As of the last official report, Arpaio had already raised nearly $8 million for his reelection. County taxpayers, meanwhile, have spent $40 million on costs related to this racial profiling litigation, which has gone on now for 8 years. Jude Joffe Block, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
Good afternoon. It's the show for Memorial Day. Along with John Hockenberry at The Takeaway, I'm Steve Goldstein. Some say the Indy 500 is the country's biggest spectator sport, but the entire city of Washington, D.C. is observing a massive multiplayer game of Veep Stakes.
Have not heard from the Trump campaign. Yep.
The speculation about the vice presidency, of course, is flattering.
I have no reason to believe that I'm even being considered. I would have no idea.
And it's her decision, ultimately.
I'm joined now by Todd Zwillick, Takeaway Washington correspondent. That's the game in D.C., picking the 2016 running mates, correct? This is the quadrennial parlor game in Washington and across the country on cable news nets. Who will the candidates pick? And there are all kinds of, well, wrinkles in this game this year because of the unknowns of Donald Trump, the unconventional candidate. Do you want to sort of go down the list, John?
Anyone can play. Is that right?
Let's talk about Chris Christie at the top. He was out early for Donald Trump right after he lost in the primary. He endorsed Donald Trump, came out on stage with him, and made a lot of people speculate that Chris Christie wants to be nominated. John Kasich, also the governor of Ohio, who stuck in the race for a long time, a conservative, thought by some people to be able to give Donald Trump some geographical cred in the swing state of Ohio and also some conservative cred. You've got a couple of other people. Mary Fallon is the governor of Oklahoma. A woman, of course, just vetoed a draconian abortion bill and sparked more speculation that she might be trying to be more palatable to independent and swing voters out there. Jan Brewer of Arizona, she's tough on immigration. She might be a choice too. But John, Donald Trump needs some national security cred. He doesn't have any experience in that. And that's made some people look towards senators like Jeff Sessions, who's on the Armed Services Committee and an advisor to Donald Trump, and also to Bob Corker from Tennessee, who's chairman of the Foreign Relations Committee. And lots of people, including me, have been running up to Bob Corker to find out if he's interested.
I have no reason to believe that I'm even being considered. I would have no idea. I get the sense that I don't even know if they've begun to think fully through those kind of things, but I just don't know. But I'm certainly have no knowledge myself.
Have no knowledge.
John, part of this parlor game is to say that you're comfortable in your job, you have no knowledge of it, you've never been contacted. You can't be too eager. And that's why you heard that montage at the top of a bunch of senators and congresspeople and everybody else saying they haven't heard it, they don't know it, they're not interested. Because if you're too eager, you can't get the job, right? You heard also from Joni Ernst. She's the Republican freshman senator from Iowa. She's a woman. She's a conservative. She's a military veteran. She's not interested. She hasn't talked to Donald Trump about it. And just a couple other outside picks just to keep in the back of your mind. How about Newt Gingrich? He's interested in the job. He's said openly that he would take the job if it was offered to him. And what about Joe Arpaio, the anti-immigrant sheriff of Maricopa County? He gets on TV a lot. Outside pick. Outside pick. One in a thousand.
Totally. Yeah, one in a million.
But there are some of your top picks for the Republican parlor game there, John.
Well, let's spin the Democratic wheel, shall we?
Absolutely. Now, the parlor game is a little more confined in Hillary land because she's such a traditional politician. So people are looking for more traditional candidates in her candidacy. And a lot of this for her is going to depend on who Trump picks over the summer. But let's start with some of the obvious choices. Julian Castro is the HUD secretary. He has a brother who's also in Congress. He's Latino. He's from Texas. He's young. He's popular. And he's got great demographics. Deval Patrick, the liberal former governor of Massachusetts. He's African American. And Tom Perez, labor secretary, currently in the Obama administration, gets quite a lot of buzz for Hillary. But there are a couple of other people, John, who get major buzz for Hillary, but they've got some problems. Here's the obvious choice that a lot of liberals on the left, including Bernie Sanders himself, have said that they might think would be a good choice, Elizabeth Warren.
What kind of a man does that? I'll tell you exactly what kind of a man does that. It is a man who cares about no one but himself.
John, that's Elizabeth Warren at a charity event in Washington just last week. Why do people love her? She gives Hillary Clinton access to a part of the electorate that she's been hurting in the race with Bernie Sanders. Liberals, young voters, young women, anti-Wall Street Democrats, people who Hillary has trouble with. Elizabeth Warren shores that up for her potentially. She's great on the internet. She's a huge fundraiser. You heard in that tape right there, she was talking about Donald Trump, of course. She's made a lot of hay, both behind microphones and on Twitter, for playing the attack dog role, going after Donald Trump. And she hasn't endorsed any candidates in this race, and that's pricked up a lot of ears around here about the potential for an Elizabeth Warren vice presidential candidate. And then you also have Sherrod Brown, the liberal Democratic pro-labor, pro-union senator from Ohio.
I've had no substantive conversations with the nominee, with the prospective nominee. I love this job. I don't aspire to be vice president of the United States. I'm honored to get to fight for the overtime rule that we just handed down to the Department of Labor and the Earned Income Tax Credit and all the things that with the steelworker jobs in Ohio, all that.
Isn't there a double-edged sword if you're talking about people in the Senate moving over to become somebody's running mate because the Senate is perhaps in play?
No, there's no question about it. Now, here's the problem with both Warren and Sherrod Brown. They'd both be great candidates for Hillary, but they both come from states with Republican governors. If they run for VP, those Republican governors get to appoint Republicans to the seat, and Democrats are trying to take back the Senate.
Well, it goes beyond Capitol Hill. There, I saw John Hickenlooper from Colorado, the governor, on the talk shows on MSNBC. He's got a memoir. Oh, isn't that convenient? Out in 2016. Doesn't that signal that they're maybe looking to be a vice president?
Hickenlooper has made all the appropriate denials that it's not going to happen, that he's not interested. He has that book out. He's keeping a high profile, and he's from an important swing state in the Intermountain West that geographically would be important for Hillary. The question there is whether she goes with that geographical choice or more of a constituency choice, somebody like Elizabeth Warren. I don't think those decisions have been made yet, but you can see all the calculations that go on that fuel this parlor game that we all love to play so much.
Todd Zwillick, our resident historian and Washington correspondent. Thank you so much.
You got it, John.
That's John Hockenberry at The Takeaway. Today, we continue our celebration of the working life. We're looking at the people who do the jobs you sometimes don't see or don't think about. Today, we step into a day on the job pumping septic tanks and cesspools.
My name's Shane Bob. I'm a septic technician with Green Arrow Environmental. We're at a country club in McKellips, getting ready to do a septic pull and pump, what we call. So just pretty much pop the lid and throw my hose in it and do my job. Normally, first thing I'll look for on a job like this is make sure there's no dogs. Just go around the area, make sure everything's safe for one. Like this job, this is a cesspool. They don't use these. They haven't used them in years. This would be a system that has gone way too long and has not been maintained. The homeowner was having issues with smells. People don't realize it's like a car. You have to maintain them. If you don't pump it regularly, then what happens is all the solids end up building up in your system. And it could cause damage. It's gonna start coming back through the system. So when that happens, this is what you get, this mess right here. It has gone back into the tank and now it is going back into the home. Okay, so what I'm gonna do is I'm gonna start vacuuming out from the clean out to relieve some of the pressure from the house. Casey, how you doing?
Good to see you, man. How are you? Thanks, good. You guys for showing up.
That was Casey, that was the homeowner. It's gonna get loud now, so I'm gonna turn the pump on and start pumping down the cesspool. It's not dirty like you think it would. There's a clean way and there's a dirty way of doing this. And you do it the clean way, you know, you don't get sick, you go home clean every day. So there's a good days and there's bad days with every job. But overall, I like what I do and it's kind of unique in its own way, its own weird way.
That's Shane Bob pumping a cesspool in the East Valley. We'll have another look at somebody's job next Monday. The term stereotype is usually considered to be negative, as it's seen as something that lumps groups of people together, sometimes without considering individuals. For example, people of Asian descent can be labeled as smarter than their peers in the areas of math and science, and that can lead to other problems. In a few minutes, we'll hear from an Indian woman who has lived in the U.S. for 4 decades about the experiences she's had with stereotypes. We start with Todd Patinsky, a social psychologist and professor at Stony Brook University who studies stereotypes. Todd, do you think of stereotypes initially as negative?
Folks who have taken a school class at some point on stereotypes will notice that while we often think about it and talk about it as negative, the actual definition of a stereotype is simply an oversimplification or a simplified representation of another group. And so the definition is certainly open. So I think of it as positive and negative. I think of the idea that mothers are nurturing, elderly people are kind. I think there's a whole bunch of stereotypes that are out there that are very much stereotypes, but very different than what we typically think of.
Why do stereotypes persist? Is it because there is great truth in them?
So a colleague and I started an article we were calling the kernel of truth is the seed of trouble. So very often there is a sort of a real-world basis for a stereotype. The way that I have my students think about it, the way I would encourage your readers to think about it, would be there's the stereotype, which is simply what's the general representation of another group. But the real issue or the real challenge for society is the stereotyping, which is when you take a representation and you apply it to any one individual. So whether or not a stereotype describes a group, it still doesn't tell you about the person across the desk from you or the person that you're meeting for the first time, because for any group, there's a lot of variability.
What do we make of a positive stereotype which seems positive but may have sort of a backhandedness to it?
It can be complicated. For example, you can imagine if a teacher has the stereotype that, you know, kids from Asian or Southeast Asian cultures, you know, are particularly adept or particularly good in math, he or she may spend less time with them. And so you could imagine that actually not only does it minimize the effort that these kids might be putting in to do their excellent work, but you could imagine a lot of cases where the stereotype is leading the teacher to really ignore or overlook students who would benefit from help. You know, that said, it does go back to the kernel of truth, though, because if you look, for example, in the U.S., we have a lot of discussions about stereotypes in academic achievement, and we spend a lot of time trying to understand why African Americans and Latinos on some of the large testing programs fare relatively less well than Caucasian Americans. We don't yet understand or pay attention to the fact that Caucasian Americans consistently underperform relative to Asian Americans.
So, Todd, how much can stereotypes, positive or negative, kind of undermine our individuality? Does that happen frequently?
I think it does, and I would actually argue that they're more potentially, they're undermining individuality even more than negative stereotypes. And the example that I give would be if someone is applying a negative stereotype, so if I said, hey, you're an NPR host, so you must have certain negative traits, I would imagine, Steve, you would be pretty quick to interrupt me and say, wait a minute, you know, some NPR hosts may be that. But if I came back and said, you're an NPR host, so you're probably thoughtful, you're probably generous of spirit, you're probably willing to look at issues from all sides, you're probably going to let me go on with that characterization much more than if I came up with negative attributes.
So, right, just keep so going. Keep going with those, Todd. Yes, please. Thanks.
We can extend the segment. So I would argue in day-to-day life, there's absolutely risk to positive stereotypes, but I would also argue that groups are really important to people, the groups that we're a part of, and a big part of group identity is getting together and sharing some of the traits or qualities that we relish about the groups that we're a part of.
Todd Patinsky, professor at Stony Brook University. He studies stereotypes. Rachel Misra moved to the U.S. from India in 1973. She says she's witnessed positive and negative stereotypes applied to her and her family. And Rachel, when you hear the stereotype that people of Indian or Asian descent are smarter or better at academics, what do you think of?
That is something that you hear quite a bit because I've been in this country from 1973. I'm who I am because of my hard work and dedication and also many of the values that we Asians and especially Indians really think are important, that hard work, dedication, things like that are going to take you places.
Do you think that Asian kids have the stereotype of being expected to get straight A's, for example? And is there a complex that can develop if everyone thinks you're the smartest person in the room and then all of a sudden you might make some sort of error and you get 97 on a test as opposed to 100, and then maybe your peers are thinking, oh, well, you're not as smart as you thought you were. Can that cause problems in and of itself?
Yeah, and that is definitely there. But at the same time, you know, parents kind of realize with each child, it's a different. Like I have two children and with a boy and a girl, the things have been really, you know, very different. You know, there are certain subjects, for example, they toil more than others, you know. So if it is a subject that they're having high, you know, problem getting the A's or something like that, I think most of the parents will say that, okay, let's see what we can do to help you out with that. Another thing which is very typical of good number of Asian parents is that they go to the schools very often to meet with the teachers. So when you're talking about parent-teacher meetings, you know, Asian parents very often are there at the front asking parents to do that.
There is almost this feeling, I think this comes across in academics, also comes across in athletics, that people who look like they're not trying quite as hard and yet still excel are somehow seen, put on a higher pedestal in essence. Is there a danger in that, that people, again, coming back to this idea that there is a more of a natural talent, can that backfire in more ways than one?
Yeah. I mean, sometimes it is true that some of the children have this giftedness. You know, my son, for example, has very high IQ. And when he was in elementary school, and of course, you know, we were two small children and in a small city that was new for us, we thought that we should start them in a school. Our son used to get into trouble in the beginning. We didn't understand what it was until the principal called us to meet with them. And he said that, do you know your son has been, you know, signing his name for his dad and bringing notes back because there were some issues with us. So we met, but then found out, you know, so we asked our son, why are you doing this? You know, he said, because the kids in the classroom are calling me names like walking encyclopedia, you're a genius, and yeah, things like that. And as a result of it, he had to retaliate in a way that he knew how to. So there are that exceptions. There's, you know, few students you find are, you know, over the guidelines. But many of the other children, they kind of think that, you know, I mean, why, if I do good, you know, other kids are going to be giving me trouble or something. And mm-hmm. as a result of it, you know, you see that tendency in some of the children. But on the other hand, it's up to the teachers to find out that, hey, so-and-so has more potential. It's not coming through.
Rachel Misra is a retired educator originally from India. We've been talking about positive and negative stereotypes. It's the show on 91.5. Thanks for listening. Along with Mark Brody, I'm Steve Goldstein.
Animated movies can bring in a lot of money from box office sales, and increasingly they can take on subjects not previously discussed in kids' movies.
Zootopia, a gleaming city where animals of all breeds, predator and prey alike, live together in peace and harmony.
Disney's Zootopia has been one of this year's biggest box office hits and has generated buzz for including social commentary on issues ranging from hypocrisy to race. Kevin Sandler is an associate professor in the English department at ASU and specializes in film and media studies. And Kevin, are kids' movies really taking on more social themes?
I think that you can say that to some extent. I mean, there's certainly some movies out there in which the environmental, in which the immigrant issues, climate change, and other environmental issues play a more pronounced role. So, for instance, you have a film like Zootopia, in which a lot of people have written about, certainly dealing with the issue of Islamophobia, as well as being an allegory on prejudice. I mean, that's pretty much very present in the text, but other movies have that as well.
Is that a conscious decision on the part of the filmmakers?
I think these are all conscious positions on the parts of filmmakers. I look at filmmaking as someone's got to put the stuff in there. However, you still have to deal with the fact that you have producers and brands and other issues within a giant media conglomerate such as Disney or Fox who want to be able to sell tickets. So the question is, what's the balance between being an allegory and being entertainment?
Well, where is that balance?
I think the balance exists depending really on the film, because you have to look at each film as an individual object and then see, well, is there a lot of films out there that really try to address these kind of social concerns? And I'm thinking about the various films that deal with this, and, you know, there's not, I think, as many as Zootopia. I think Zootopia is a very special case. I mean, you have WALL-E from 2008, and that deals with environmental destruction. You have Happy Feet, and that's dealing with overfishing and pollution. And even something more recent, such as Lego in 2014, which is perhaps a critique on capitalism and big business, or even Home from 2015, which is dealing with immigration issues. But amidst all these stories and amidst these allegories on these various subjects, for the most part, these are movies about self-discovery. That is the most important kind of narrative thread.
Are these aimed more at the parents who are taking their kids to the movies? I mean, I can imagine, you know, a 4 or 5 year old probably wouldn't get some of those themes.
I believe that's certainly correct. However, parents take their kids to these movies, and these animation films are certainly much more than just the films themselves for these giant corporations. These animation films are big business for them, not just simply in ticket prices, but in experiences later down the line at amusement parks, at the various products that people buy. And so they want to get as large of an audience as possible and create stories that attract as large an audience as possible.
To do that, though, it would seem to me that producers and studios and all those people would need to keep the themes kind of mild, because you don't want to turn people off, you know, on a particular theme. You want as many people to see a movie, so you don't want to be sort of preaching at them, right?
I believe that's certainly true. I mean, these movies first and foremost need to be about self-discovery. They don't have to be about politics, but it's kind of that social element that may bring more and more adults in and lead to repeat viewing and perhaps lead them to want to buy products associated with that property, you know, over and over and over, as well as to visit various amusement parks and so forth.
I'm interested to hear you say that they want to try to appeal to both kids and parents, because I think of when I watch Sesame Street with my kids, there's some stuff in there that I guarantee you that the little ones don't get, but I think they're hilarious. And it seems like even back when The Muppet Show was on originally, back when I was a kid, there were a lot of sort of jokes and maybe some themes on there that went way over my head that my parents thought were really funny. So it seems like this idea isn't necessarily a new one.
No, it certainly is not. But at certain times in history, some shows which you think might be for kids now were actually produced for adults. I think in the 70s and 80s, you had animation that was appealing, you know, primarily to kids. And if it did attract an adult audience, so be it. But it wasn't part of a much larger multimedia international campaign on the part of large corporations to attract as many people as possible.
Kevin Sandler is an associate professor in the English department at ASU, specializing in film and media studies. We were talking about animated kids' movies taking on more social themes.
This natural resource was brought into the valley during the Great Depression, and when it arrived, it was one of a kind. Nadine Arroyo Rodriguez reports for KJZZ.
It was the 1930s, and the country was dealing with a financial crisis. In the Southwest, including Arizona, something else was developing: natural gas. Did you know the El Paso Natural Gas Line came all the way into the valley?
El Paso Natural Gas Company, they were established in 1929 to construct a pipeline between Jal, New Mexico, which was in the heart of the Permian Basin, to El Paso, which was one of the only cities in Texas at the time that did not have natural gas.
Thomas Jones is a historic archaeologist who has done extensive research on this natural gas line, named after the company that created it.
With the onset of the Great Depression, after their successful installation, they had no choice but to expand in order to survive as a company and keep their employees employed. And so they expanded the line to Douglas for another 100 miles. I think it was about 125 miles or so.
Jones says by 1934, the El Paso Natural Gas Line was extended northwest from Douglas to Phoenix for about 220 miles. This gas path was identified as the 1007th line.
From Douglas, it went through Cochise County, through Tombstone, and then it continued west into Pima County and Tucson, pretty much following the current I-10 corridor up into Phoenix. I think the main entrance is on 48th Street, just north of us.
Walking along 48th Street, just south of Baseline Road in Phoenix, is the El Paso Natural Gas Line District Office. This is the general area where the 1007th line ended. The natural gas that was transmitted here was sold to residents and businesses.
At the time, they only had limited electricity, but with natural gas, they had a whole new form. So, yeah, it did represent a real step, a real advance in the residential development of Phoenix.
There are remnants of the El Paso Natural Gas Line throughout the state. One in particular is in Tempe. On Rural Road, south of Baseline, is a bike and pedestrian walkway that leads into a nearby park. This path is named after the line. because below it is a subline that branched from the main gas line. Jones says in his research he discovered that the El Paso Natural Gas Line in Arizona was built by Arizonans. Remember, this was the 1930s during the Depression. Jones says local union political and business leaders pressured the natural gas company not to use machines, but to hire locals. So as the line was being built from one county to another, about 1,000 men in each area were hired along the way to build it. It's the show. I'm Nadine Arroyo Rodriguez.
And if you have any ideas you think would make for good stories, give us an email, theshow@kjzz.org. That's the show for today. This has been a KJZZ original production from Phoenix. You can find photos, audio segments, and more information about the program at theshow.kjzz.org. I'm Steve Goldstein. Thanks for listening to the show podcast.